So welcome, Kathy Dooley, and welcome everybody to this course on migraines. This is one of a series of courses Kathy's been doing with eHealth Learning. And so there are repeat students that are very excited to be joining us, and some of you are new. We're expecting about 26 this evening. A lot of last minute signups. Thank you for joining us for this course, this being the first paid session. I hope you've all catched the introduction Kathy did last week at the same time. And thank you for taking time in your busy schedule to do a Kathy download on migraines for us practitioners to follow up on in our practices. And I've made you co-host, so over to you for this hour. And I'll be here to support anybody with questions or comments, and may have some of my own. Over to you.
Great,
I'll let you
great.
introduce yourself with that Kathy set up ID and Immaculate Dissection, and has lots of wonderful courses there online and in person. And your exercise physiologist, anatomist, and clinical anatomist. You've done lots of dissections, and you're a chiropractor and body worker. Yeah.
Wow, you are so good. You got it all, I think. That's amazing.
Cool.
That's very true. I just got done doing 4 hours of human dissection, and so I it's a big part of my life, anatomy. I don't believe that one can understand the body with really and how it functions without having a great foundation of anatomy. So for me, anatomy is how I make sense of everything. So when I was struck with migraine, for my very first migraine at age 23, for me, it was this very uncomfortable world. It was learning how to discern the difference between headache and migraine, because they are very different. I had had headaches before, but I'd never had migraine. And to be able to make sense of why it was happening with anatomy. And I really hope to impart that with you over the next 3 Wednesdays. A better understanding of what's happening. Research is growing for our understanding, although the causative agents of migraine, the mechanism is still somewhat elusive. But I want to share with you what we know, which is kind of a lot. Some of the things that were misconstrued for a while, what we thought migraine was and how it has changed and morphed, I think will be really, really interesting for you folks to see and understand. So in this first Wednesday, what I would like to do is talk to you about discerning the difference between headache and migraine. I also want to talk to you about the trigeminal nerve, which is a huge part of migraine's nociception or pain awareness. And I also want to talk to you about a concept called cortical spreading depression. And I don't know if that's new for you folks and if you've heard of it before. But it will be a very important concept for the pathomechanism of migraine and how we as therapists can contribute to helping people with migraine. Okay, I hope you guys are excited to get started. I think that I, in this weird way, I was put on this earth partially to discuss migraine. Maybe that's why I'm one of the people that's afflicted with it. And anatomy was my worst board score. Just want to put that out there. I know I've said that on other talks with embodied health learning, but it really was not my strong suit. But I really do think that anyone can turn a weakness or something that happens to you into a strength. I call it the silver linings playbook of what happens to us. And on that note, I would like for you to understand just some basics. If you watched our promo talk, I kind of gave you some teasers about this. And also, I want to get you guys excited about anatomy. And so I'm going to be giving away a nerve referral poster. It's one of our ID posters that has the dermatomes and sclerotomes and peripheral nerve distribution, and including the trigeminal nerve on it, as well as your deep tendon reflexes. It's just an amazing chart. It's 24 by 36, huge poster. And it's usually $100 on our website, US, but I'm going to give it to you folks for free. So somebody has to answer a question right for me at the end of this. So if you could just pay attention, and I'll let you know when I ask the question, but I'm going to give away a free one at some point today. So just make sure you use the chat box to ask any of your questions. And also make sure to just pay a little bit of attention. You don't have to have an anatomy degree to understand the anatomy of migraine, but I just want you to get to know the anatomy of migraine a little bit more. So today, let's just talk first about what the heck even is migraine and how is it different than a headache? Because it's not the same. And I just want to propose that it's not the same. Okay, so you probably saw this in the promo talk. Headaches and migraines, what they have in common is tension, discomfort, nociception being pain reception, in or around the head, okay? Headaches tend to be associated with other processes, whereas migraine tends to be more, especially chronic migraine, can be its own event. It's not that it doesn't have its comorbidities, like people with diabetes can have migraine, people with hypertension can have migraine, but headaches are typically not so much a standalone event. Typically, they coincide with many other things, whereas people can be very, very healthy otherwise and have a history of migraines. So this infographic is really nice because they say headaches can be a symptom of an illness, whereas migraines are the illness, especially when we talk about the chronicity of migraine. So how are they different? Why are they so confused? Why are they so easily misdiagnosed as headache? What is it about them why is it such a struggle to do a solid differential diagnosis? Well, I think that we kind of accept headaches, and a lot of people don't know they have migraine until they are actually diagnosed with it. I had no idea. I remember at age 23, by between ages 6 and 23, I had headaches that were associated with my visual problem. And I never knew that I had migraine until age 23. I was prescribed an oral contraceptive, and I was prescribed the wrong one. I was on a low dose oral contraceptive, estradiol, and I was accidentally given a high estradiol dose. The names were very similar. They both started with an A. I think both are off the market now, ironically. But the thing for me is that triggered my system to become hypersensitized towards migraines. So with people with migraine, they have this hypersensitivity of the cerebrum. And that is very different than a headache. A headache can be caused by so many different things, but a migraine, the vast majority of migraines have a very similar pathomechanism for the most part. And they all involve these triggers that we'll discuss. And understanding triggering can be a really big piece, and understanding the trigeminal nerve and the thalamus, as well as the parietal lobe, can be a really big piece. And it already probably sounds like, oh my gosh, why is, like, you might have 80 people show up to a GAIT talk and then like 20 people show up to migraine. But folks, 34 million Americans experience migraine every year. 34 million Americans, that's a tenth of our population. And actually, that is an understatement. I think the data is probably higher than that, but people are not always diagnosed with migraine. They're diagnosed with headache. And the thing about migraine is that the symptoms are just not quite the same. So just for a basis of comparison, headaches don't tend to get worse with movement so much, but migraines nearly always do. The most consistent symptom for someone with a migraine history is that the pain is exacerbated by movement. Let me give you an example. Like for me personally, going from lay to sit, like I'll sometimes wake up with a migraine. I don't have it when I'm laying there, but when I turn in bed, you know, to kiss my dog or husband, I'll start to feel it. And then if I get up from a lay to sit position, I'll start to feel it. That is very common with migraine. Ironically, it's not even the headache part that's the most consistent, but the pain with movement part that's the most consistent in peer review. So of course, the headache and migraine both have pain involved, but a headache tends to be a little bit more diffuse in nature, like the back of the skull or around the sinuses or around the forehead, versus migraine is a unilateral headache. It's located on one side of you. That's because of the cerebral process that we'll talk about in the trigeminal afferents that we'll talk about. So the unilateral nature is very consistent with migraine. For migraine sufferers, they know the difference between a headache and a migraine, usually based upon the fact that headaches don't hurt more when you move necessarily. Migraines always, almost always do. And headaches are hardly ever unilateral, where migraines tend to be unilateral, right? Headaches are very rarely coupled with nausea and vomiting, versus migraine is a brainstem and cerebral disorder. And I know that sounds like, oh, it's a neurological disorder. I'm like, well, kind of, yes. Not even kind of. They're starting to find that it's more of that than a systemic disease necessarily. So with migraine, there is very common to get nausea and vomiting. The change that we'll talk about in the vasculature, the tonicity of the vasculature, as well as the fact that the nausea and vomiting is monitored by cranial nerves, that sensation. So things like trigeminal and vagus. So that's a really big distinction between them, right? Now, aura, people like to think that aura is necessarily migraine, and the vast majority of people with migraine don't get an aura, visual scotoma, visual scintillations, like weird visual things, which we'll talk about next week a little bit more. But most people with migraine don't have that. So it's not even considered to be a common symptom, right? But the nausea and vomiting definitely are. Another thing that people with headache don't tend to get that people with migraine get is sensory sensitivity. And this is extreme. It's not like, ouch, the music is too loud. It's more like headache, that music is a little too loud, versus migraine, that music is intolerable. Same thing with light or smells. People can have like photophobia, right? They can have olfactory phobia too. Like they don't want to, like everything that smells intense. For me, I tend to get that symptom first, where I'll notice that my sense of smell is extremely acute. And like things like coffee, which I really like, or like my snacks, which I like, they suddenly become almost too intense to bear. And that for me is part of a stage that we'll discuss here in a second. And so these intense sensory relationships, again, very much thalamus mediated, your relay center, your bouncer of the sensory club, right? If the thalamus starts getting sensitized and starts letting in more information, right? So if migraine patients have this hypersensitivity to a lot of sensations, and people with headache may not crave sensory deprivation, but people with migraine almost always do. They want a dark room, they want no smells, no sounds, and they want to just go to sleep. It's very common for people with migraine to report that. So the big differences, right? The position, unilaterally versus bilaterally. Headaches are bilateral, migraines are unilateral typically. The fact that there is the nausea and vomiting present with migraine, but not so much present with headache, right? The photophobia, the phonophobia, the olfactory phobia, the sensory perceptions are so much more heightened in migraine and in headache, not so much. And the fact that, you know, migraine is, it is very, very commonly something that has all these brainstem mediated events versus headache doesn't really have that accompaniment, right? Now, not all people with migraine are chronic, which we'll discuss, but it's proposed that 20% of the population will have a migraine in their lifetime, 20%, right? That's a huge amount for us to not talk about it. It's like one out of every five people. That's a lot of people. So other symptoms, you know, of course, can include some other things. Let me just find the piece. I just can't seem to find it here. Hold on. I have a really cool chart for you, but for some reason it's not popping up. Let me try that again. Sorry, guys. I had a tech fail. Here we go. Just another like infographic symptom chart. The five majors, like the nausea, the sensitivity, the vomiting, the unilateral headache are so common. Another common one, I'm sorry, I forgot about, which is not present with headache, is throbbing pain. Throbbing pain is a huge, huge component. So the unilateral head pain, the throbbing pain, the nausea and vomiting, the hypersensitivity to light, all extremely common with migraine. These other ones can certainly be there or not be there. And I don't ever ask my patients unless they tell me some of the other ones, like neck aches, that's not always present with migraine. Dizziness and lightheadedness, not always present. So I'll ask those as like sub categorizations, like, do you also have these other things? But for the big ones, you know, for the migraine patient, if I wanted, you know, really think about this person has a history of migraine, this person's been properly diagnosed for migraine. With the common misdiagnosis of migraine, I like to just be that secondary source for people to understand it better. So these infographics are really helpful, and they're, the website's right below here. And so you're welcome to just snag these off the net and have them in your office, or just pull them up for your client and just ask them, like, do you have these, right? So when it comes to staging for migraine, for the experience of migraine, I thought it was important that we talked about that. And it's very significant that we find these stages where the person has basically, it's not necessarily linear, perfectly linear, but it certainly is commonly present. The first one is called the premonitory stage or prodromal stage. And this person will have some of the photophobia, phonophobia. They may have some of the dizziness or brain fog. It's very, very typical for the person to have just a weird feeling. They'll describe to you an altered feeling. And this is going to be part of something that we'll talk about, this neurogenic inflammation that kind of occurs, where the person just doesn't feel right. And so typically they have maybe like a 15-minute period upon that onset of premonitory stage before it starts to get really intense and create this cortical spreading. Some people have it up to 24 hours in advance, this weird feeling. But I would have to say I don't get that much warning. I wish I got that much warning, maybe, and maybe I would change my day. But, oh, I feel a migraine coming on tomorrow. No, it's not at all like that for me. It's more like I've got about half an hour max before I have to intervene. So some people have the light sensitivity, the sound sensitivity, the smell sensitivity. That's definitely what I have. Some people excessively yawn. And I have had patients report this to me. Like, they just feel like maybe a fatigue set in. And I do feel like that is a drop in oxygen that they're experiencing. And it's a big part of this component of migraine called vasodilation. And if you guys don't know that terminology, vasodilation is when a blood vessel starts to open up. And when this happens to your brain area, your head area, it doesn't like it. You can imagine your body has a lot of sensitivity towards drops in pressure. Okay. And so when there is this drop of oxygen pressure, the saturation of oxygen, then your body starts to have, some people will start to have a sensitivity, a neural sensitivity of the occipital lobe, the back of your skull. So if you put your hands on the back of your head, this is where your occipital lobe is, and it is your primary cortex for the visual apparatus. So many people, they start to get visual disturbances. And most of them are visual. They don't have to be visual, but a lot of times they're visual. And for the people that experience it, it's called an aura. An aura is an altered sensory perception. It doesn't have to be the visual, but it's a depressed ability due to hyperexcitability of the occipital lobe to be able to properly manage the sensory perceptions. And a lot of that is light. For me, it's more olfaction. But I do notice after the olfaction, sometimes a change in light, but I don't actually see any visual disturbances like the scotoma, the scintillating lights. And some people do experience that, where they'll have a disturbance. You can have aura without having migraine. Like I do, I have had auras before in absentia of migraine, but they're very freaky for the people that experience them. And then they know something's coming. And that's, it's going to be coming very soon. Typically within that, you know, when aura sets in, you have minutes, right? Now, the thing that's consistent with all people with a migraine typically is the pain attack. And this is meant that when we talk about the concepts, the neurological concepts of what's occurring, the pain that's associated with the head is usually that very intense throbbing, you know, it tends to be way more unilateral than bilateral discomfort. and the extreme throbbing and sensitivity to sound, and then nausea and vomiting. That's the big symptoms we were talking about. They tend to fit in right here in the middle, in the green, right? And so we either intervene with our methods that kind of calm it, but for the most part, what most people will report is that they want to get to the resolution stage, which is stage four, and that is sleep. Consistently, people with migraine want to be in a state of sensory deprivation, and this is all senses, sound off, light off, smells off, stimulation off. You know, they don't want to be having a consistent conversation with you. They want to sleep, typically. They want rest and sleep. And sleep is very hard for people with migraine because there's this very scary element of nociception. It's really, really tough to sleep. Not to mention the fact we'll talk about over the course of the 3 hours, the neurotransmitters involved with this. Sometimes they have neurotransmitter dysfunction or receptor dysfunction. It makes it even harder for them to sleep, and which may be one of the reasons why they have migraine. And then the recovery stage, which we call postdrome. Prodrome was pre, right? Postdrome was after. And this can be, you know, anywhere from 24 hours to 72 hours. For most people, they experience different things. For me, I experience a sense of elation and that is reported in the literature. Like they call it euphoria. And I wouldn't necessarily deem it euphoria. Just because you feel kind of still a residual trigeminal neuralgia of sorts, but it's a feeling of thankfulness and gratefulness. That's what I experience. Just like, oh, okay, I didn't die today. And I know that sounds super dramatic, but it really does feel very, very serious when it's happening. And I'm not going to denote the fact that it's not an emergent event, but it certainly does feel emergent. It feels serious. And so that's, you know, the chemicals that are starting to get normalized that are also neurotransmitters can affect the mood. So typically there's a stage of fatigue, elation that can occur. So that would be your postdrome stage. So that's the staging. And that helps you kind of recognize. For me, it was really nice when I was diagnosed with migraine because I think a good 5 months of having migraine chronically, with chronic being more than 5 episodes per month, right? It was really, at my worst, it was 3 a week, which is very out of control. And that's 12 a month, that's a lot. So for me, it was really, really hard to get the proper diagnosis because people would just cast it off, which we'll talk about in future hours. But it was once I got a proper diagnosis, kind of understanding it, that it's not just going to go away. It's just not something that necessarily vanishes. It is a chronic condition for a lot of people. So there is an understanding of management and understanding of mechanism. And so seeing that in front of me, I had a really, really good doctor that really broke it down for me, a really great neurologist who broke it down for me. And he said, you know, these are the stages and this is what you should expect just so you can prepare. And I don't know, it really helped to know I wasn't crazy, to know I wasn't the only one to experience it. And he was like, no, millions of people. He's like, there's like a $30 billion loss of productivity per year in the United States alone. And over the world, there's a loss of productivity in pretty much every nation that experiences migraine. It's just like, wow. And to lose billions of years in productivity due to people calling out due to migraine, it would behoove us to understand it better and be able to have, you know, clinical interventions for it. So that's it. That's the staging. So are you guys interested in this concept called cortical spreading depression? This is something I never really knew about until I experienced migraine. And it's just been really talked about in the last like 5 to 10 years, as far as the mechanisms. They really didn't understand what was happening with migraine. They thought it was just, hey, a blood vessel gets dilated and the oxygen drops. So they called it a vascular issue. And I'm not saying it's not a vascular issue. And the research is still very much in debate about how much they want to deem it a vascular issue. It's more than that, though. like what's promoting the vasodilation. So there is this component of genetics, this huge component of gender, and there's the other component of change. So when you think of genetics, gender, and change, these are the people that can be more susceptible to migraine. So I hit every marker that was going to make me have migraine. So genetically, I have certain types of receptors that serotonergic receptors that are probably a little faulty. I have a family history of depression and my mom has migraine. So that was working against me. I'm female. So, you know, it's 3-to-1 ratio of people with migraine, female to male. So it's just much more common for females to get it. And then the change part. For me, it was a big change in my oral contraceptives. And being that my migraines are promoted by hormone mostly, it's not the only piece, but it's a big piece. This is probably what makes females more susceptible. In fact, females that go through menopause, their migraine incidence plummets. I've never looked more forward to menopause in my entire life than when I heard that my migraines might get lessened. I know that I'll have to deal with other things, but woo! The huge amount of joy I'm going to experience going through menopause if one of its side effects is a decrease in migraine. So estrogen plays a big part because estrogen is a vasodilator. And so as estrogen starts to plummet, it's harder to get the blood vessels to dilate as much, which is not so great for the heart, but better for your migraines. So I guess it's a catch 22. The big thing that with change is that it's not just estrogen. It was for me, but it can be change in barometric pressures. It can be changes in stress levels, sleep, food timing. It can be changes in environment. So there's a lot of components that go with the big change. But when you're thinking of genetics, gender, change as the three big features of what makes one have a migraine, it's very important for one to start to track their triggers. And so I know my triggers really well because in October, it will be 20 years that I've endured migraine, right? That I've been a migraineur is what they call it, a migraine. I don't like to call it migraine sufferer as much as migraineur. That's what the researchers in Stanford say. And as a migraineur, the things that you have to identify are the pieces that trigger you because the triggering is different for everyone. The commonality between triggers for people is some food additives like sulfites that are in wine and aged cheeses. Also cheeses are high in taurine. Taurine is a type of protein, amino acid that can encourage fluctuations in inhibitory chemicals like serotonin, melatonin, serotonin particularly, and that's a vasoconstrictor. So it can kind of alter some of that. So you have to be kind of careful with, you know, the taurine consumption. And then also, MSG, monosodium glutamate, basically processed foods, like foods that have gone through a lot of processing. If I'm not really allowed to buy things in the middle of the grocery store, my husband and I have to stay in the periphery since if you can't pronounce it, you probably shouldn't consume it kind of thing. If you don't recognize it, you probably shouldn't consume it. And the words get pretty tricky, and so you may not recognize it. And so these chemicals can create changes in the way that they're basically excitotoxins is what they're deemed as. So they excite the cells. And in migraine sufferers or migraineurs, they tend to have already an excitability potential, which was triggered by whatever, estrogen, environment, what have you. And so knowing that those particular food triggers can increase your incidence. The sleep deprivation is known to be a huge one. I was also going through chiropractic school. I had just started chiropractic school when my migraines got triggered. And so that change of being this really intense student was a big one for me as well. Pressure systems. I can definitely tell you if it's going to rain or not. It's weird. Like this, you know, I should have probably been a meteorologist, right? That was never something I could do when I was younger, but could do, you know, after the initiation of chronic migraine onset. So what happens is that the person gets triggered. They have this increase of excitability of the occipital cortex particularly. So let me pull this up for you, this concept of cortical spreading depression. So what'll happen, just finding the right picture. Sorry, guys. Let me just pause for a second and find the right one, because there's a beautiful picture of it and it's anatomical, which is always my favorite. It's not words, it's anatomy. So what ends up happening is you get really excited through this posterior part of the cortex, and it starts to create an inhibitory response. Like the neurons get depressed and because they get so overexcited that there's like a depressive event. And then there's this change in potassium concentration gradients. And when you change the potassium concentration gradients, a couple of mechanisms occur. One is that you'll start to stimulate some of the tryptamine pathways in the body. And that starts to directly affect the thalamus. And then you start to alter glutamate, a particular neurotransmitter, and then you affect the meninges with the covering of the brain, right? And that's where the pain reception is. The brain itself has no pain. Isn't that funny? The brain doesn't perceive anything. It's its coverings is what's really hurting you in migraine. The other component is that when you change the potassium gradients due to this neurogenic inflammatory cascade, what will happen is that you basically create an influx of nociception. So how this happens is that as this cortical spreading depression occurs through the occipital lobe to the parietal lobe is your where you perceive pain, you end up having this this massive change in the dilation of vessels. So potassium is really important for potassium and sodium in particular are very important for the management of fluid exchange. And so as your potassium starts to get affected, you have a drop in your blood pressure going up to the brain, and that's the vasodilation that occurs. And the brain, as you can imagine, has a sensory system to tell it whenever there is a decrease in oxygen. And so when you have this signaling occur, these chemicals, and they're shown here, like this calcitonin gene-related peptide. It's a part of the excitatory cascade here. Other chemicals called the substance P and TIP, VIP, they're all related to the relationship of you stimulating the nerve that actually innervates those blood vessels in the dura mater. And that nerve is the trigeminal nerve, right? So the trigeminal nerve is innervating these meninges. This is called supratentorial dura. So all of the dura mater that's really high up here, right? Down here, it's more vagus and cervical nerves, right? But up here, it's more consistent for people to have that intense cranial pressure and sensitivity. It's called allodynia, where you can barely touch the person's scalp. That's very consistent with migraine due to this process of neurogenic inflammation. So as this inflammatory cascade starts to dilate blood vessels due to this potassium change in gradients, then you end up stimulating the trigeminal nerve through these neuropeptides and you end up feeling intense pain. So the person is not stroking out. The person is not actually in imminent danger. That's why it's not an emergency room situation. It's just severely uncomfortable. The discomfort is really intense. So when you end up having the trigeminal nerve getting overstimulating, overexcited, all the places that are innervated by trigeminal nerve are affected. This can be into the sinus area, into the mouth and jaw. A lot of people with migraine think it's a jaw problem, right? But it's really not. It's this amazing amount of stimulation of this trigeminal ganglion, which I'll show you in a second, sending information up into the thalamus and saying, hey, we've got something wrong here. It's really, folks, migraine is referred pain. And I know I'm going to give you guys a nerve chart, but referred pain is really, really interesting. Can I teach you guys a trick? I know this is really sciencey. I'm going to come away from it for a second. The trigeminal nerve does sensory innervation to your face, to your dura mater on the inside of your skull, right? And it also does sensory innervation to blood vessels. So that's why you're getting this neurogenic inflammation, this information stimulating receptors, the information is going down to trigeminal saying something's wrong, something's wrong, something's wrong. You know, Kathy's, you know, vasodilated. This is not good. You know, she's sending out too much histamine. She's got neurogenic inflammation. Increase her sensitivity. So she stops whatever she's doing in her tracks and heals, right? But really it's just, I could sit next to someone who doesn't have migraine and they could eat the same sulfites, eat the same nitrites, have the same stress load and not necessarily experience it because they don't have the particular genetics or the gender or the hypersensitivity to the trigeminal nerve and the thalamus. So it's shocking how, you know, this, it's not like you're doing anything bad. You just have to find out what triggers you and what's right for you and wrong for you. It's really, really interesting. So what ends up happening with the trigeminal nerve is just like too much afferents. And then you get this referred pain to everywhere that trigeminal goes. So can I show you that? Because it's really a fascinating nerve. It's utterly fascinating. I want to teach you a little trick so you can remember it. So folks, you see how the tip of the nose, this is called the ophthalmic division of trigeminal nerve. So if you take your fingers on the tip of your nose and just run them over your forehead like that, okay, that's what we call V1, the ophthalmic division of trigeminal nerve. Now go to the sides of your nose and to your upper lip, and then do a sweep up your cheek, kind of like you're putting on blush or you're just coming underneath the maxillary sinus, right? This area is V2, the maxillary nerve, right? That's the second root of the trigeminal nerve. And then the third is mandibular nerve. Many of you therapists know this nerve so well because if you're a craniosacral therapist or you're a manual therapist, SOT therapist, chiropractor, massage therapist, you do so much work on people's jaws, right? And so the mandibular nerve is sensory innervation to the lower lip area here, up toward the sides of the face, the temporal mandibular joint, and then up to your sideburn area, including your ear, right? You can see the top of the ear is innervated by trigeminal nerve. So this area all on one side of a person's face becomes really, really sensitized in migraine. Like for me, I'm not sure I've ever had a bilaterally oriented migraine, might have all been unilateral. This, you know, and we'll talk about some of the structural mechanisms of that component of why it's unilateral next week. But for now, I just want you to look at trigeminal nerve and how busy it is. So this is just the somatosensory, like the pain reception from these areas. But it also delivers motor. It delivers something called postganglionic parasympathetics and sympathetics, which are a fancy way to say autonomics, that control blood pressure and control mucus secretions. So people with migraine, they tend to kind of feel nasally stuffy, even though they went to the ENT and nothing's really there. That's my case, right? Just kind of feel a stuffiness. And it's just that change in sensory afferents coming on through trigeminal nerve. It's referred pain. So even though the problem is happening on a very, posterior level, at the hyperexcitability of the visual cortex, because of the cortical spreading depression happening over to the parietal lobe and the change that's happening to the dura mater because of that pressure change and concentration gradient change of potassium, you end up with an enormity of pain in the distribution of trigeminal. And this is it. So you imagine half of the face, and that's where the person feels it. They feel it behind their eye, they feel it at their head, they feel it in their nose, they feel it in their jaw. For me, the pain intensity is it's jaw and sinus, and then intense back of the eye and temporal and all the way to an area that actually co-contributes to this afferents, which is the greater occipital nerve. I'm going to show you that nerve next. Do you guys see the C2 here? This C2 is the greater occipital nerve. The greater occipital nerve also carries information back to this second part of the spinal cord and has intermingling with the brainstem. So a lot of people will get, you know, trigeminal neuralgia and greater occipital neuralgia. So they'll have pain at the back of the skull from C2, greater occipital nerve, and they'll also have pain across the side of their face, which is trigeminal. So V1, V2, V3, C2, right? C1 doesn't have any sensory. It's all motor. That's why you see it missing here, in case you wonder where it went. So the complication of migraine is understanding trigeminal nerve really well, understanding its pathway, understanding that it innervates the dura mater. And the dura mater is what's pain sensitive to the person. That's why people actually feel the pain of migraine. It's because the dura mater is the thing that's getting stimulated with this neurogenic inflammation. That's where the receptors are for trigeminal. So it's within the dura mater. Do you guys want to see that? It's a really fascinating picture. And you folks already probably know this because many of you guys are massage therapists or CSTs, but it never hurts to review this, right? This is the inside of your skull. So imagine that I just cut your cranium off, right? And then we're looking down. And so this is called the foramen magnum, a big hole. You actually have lots of holes in your skull, as you can see here. And so this is where the medulla oblongata will connect to the spinal cord. And what we like, the changes, ironically, are not happening as much here. They're happening up here. So the dura mater is the connective tissue. It's kind of like the skin on the outside of a Thanksgiving turkey. It's like really thick. Dura mater means tough mother. And it's highly, highly innervated for pain reception. And so what you're seeing here is called supratentorial dura. This is the falx cerebri. It's a piece of dura mater in between the two cerebral hemispheres. And then inside of your cranium, all around, that's all innervated by trigeminal on the inside. And it's, you know, various branches of V1, V2, and V3, but a lot of V1, a lot of ophthalmic division. And so basically, when you had that big cortical spreading depression, and you're having this neurogenic inflammation, this vasodilation occurs, the potassium starts to excite the receptors for trigeminal nerve on the dura mater. And then that information, as you can see here, is trigeminal nerve. That information comes back to trigeminal nerve's ganglion right in the center. And then it starts sending information in, telling you, look, we've got to change. Like this person's in danger of hypoxia. The brain is extremely protected by the trigeminal nerve. No, you probably don't think of trigeminal nerve having anything to do with the cerebral cortex, right? But this is what I tell myself when I have a migraine. I really talk to myself and I'm like, this is a good thing for you. You shouldn't let it get to this as often as you do, but this is a good thing that your body's doing for yourself. You're not in danger here. You need to sensory deprive. You need to calm down trigeminal nerve and let it know everything's going to be okay. And that's part of the meditation that we'll talk about in the next couple of hours of our discussion about how much trigeminal nerve is really trying to protect you. As much as I've cursed my migraines, and as much as my patients have cursed migraine, I really am the eternal optimist. And I'm like, this is a good thing that your body can feel this. If it were numb, it would be dangerous. If you didn't feel the pain, you could be in danger. You could overheat yourself. You could push yourself too hard. But migraine prevents you from being able to do that. And so in a weird way, it's like a blessing in disguise. So your occipital nerve from C2, greater occipital nerve from C2, and the trigeminal nerve are responsible for the pain that you experience. That's sending information to the thalamus, and then the thalamus to the brain, perceiving it as important. So although there's not an imminent doom, it certainly feels like it, because trigeminal is so protective. And there is this enormous hypersensitivity that occurs for the person. So that's the anatomy of what's actually happening with the mechanism of migraine. I know it's a lot. That's a lot to take in. So before I proceed, I just wanted to see if there were any questions. Do I still have you? Are you guys still here? Normally by now I see like a ton of questions in the chat box and I haven't seen any yet. So I'm just hoping you guys are still here.
Yeah, no questions so far.
No? But,
plenty of people here.
Okay. Well, I'd love to field some folks. I you know, this is a really important set of concepts. And yeah, there we go. I think they were just listening intently. Someone asked, is a cluster headache more a migraine than a headache? No, this is a great question. A cluster headache is not a migraine at all. A cluster headache is a type of headache. Let me see if I have my little type of headaches. I do. Here we go. Let me see if cluster is on them. Can you guys see this? Julian, can you see this?
Yep.
Okay. Yeah. So they don't actually have it on this list, but a cluster headache is more prominent in men than in women. And a cluster headache is unlike migraine in the fact that it comes and is very intense and then it quickly dissipates. So it's not the same mechanism of migraine, although they both involve, you know, of course, trigeminal neuralgia associated with it, because all headaches do. But they're more prominent in men. There are genetic components to them, but they're not precipitated necessarily by change of homeostasis. And they are gripping, and then they release, and then the person, you know, recovers. So the treatment of them is quite different than migraine, and the mechanism is different. It's a really good question. Really, really good question. Ironically, my mother has migraine, right? And her brother had cluster headaches. So they have both had faulty types of receptor potentials and a particular type of problem with neurotransmitters. We'll get into the neurotransmitters next time. I just didn't want to overwhelm you guys with neuroscience. And I don't know how much you guys know about neuroscience. So I do think it's really important to understand. And I think it's a big part of what we do as therapists, especially manual therapists, we need to understand when it's okay to touch someone and when it's not okay to touch someone. And a lot of that has to do with the allodynia. Like, for instance, I mean, we'll talk about it next time. I don't want to go into the therapeutic intervention just yet because we have two more hours. But so I want you guys to really understand the foundation of migraine. Touching someone when they have a migraine, it's not going to be welcome. Like, they have so much hypersensitivity, the last thing you want to do is go poking to pieces. And so, like, I remember in chiropractic school, I had this marvelous massage therapist, and he was also a craniosacral therapist, acupuncturist. I mean, he was incredible. He still is incredible. And he was going to chiropractic school to increase his skill set and his scope of practice. And I remember having like very intense migraine and being on the floor of the lab, actually. And he had to come and carry me and pick me up, and he knew not to touch my head. That's a very important thing to understand about migraine, is that when someone has that level of allodynia, one of the worst things you can do is irritate trigeminal more. So knowing when to back off is an important thing. So I'm really excited to talk to you guys about that next week, more about the neurotransmitters and the mechanisms, but it's quite different than cluster headache. Yeah, look alive on that one. Different population, different mechanism, a different duration. Someone asked, can birth trauma cause migraines? This is a really good question. I was a forceps birth. So, and my sisters, they have very similar genetics as I do, and they do not get migraines. My mom and I were both difficult births. My mom was a breech, and I was a forceps birth. I came very quickly. Mom had no epidural, no nothing. And I think that there's a growing body of support that the biomechanical dysfunction created with things like vacuum and forceps deliveries might increase someone's incidence. There's not a lot of peer review or lit review to support that that's necessarily true, but it's, for me, it's something I ask. I'm like, did you have a birth trauma? I know that I had one, so, and my sisters didn't. So that's really interesting that I would end up with one. I have the genetics for it, and I had the stressor for it. So I would consider birth trauma to be a stressor, just like anterior head carriage. Like, if I hold my phone like this, I'm probably going to increase my incidence of migraine. We'll talk about the biomechanics of all that next time, but I do think that when we talk about more of the biomechanical stuff next time, that'll be interesting to talk about again, that the birthing trauma could be one of the biomechanical factors. That's a really great question. Thank you for that. What is the frequency per month usually in chronic migraines? Five plus. If you're getting 5+ days, that's chronicity of migraine. Less than 5 is still something you want to treat, obviously, but when you get to 5+, you're now in a chronic state. Typically too, it's got to be at least 3 months in incidence to be deemed chronic. So 3 months of 5 times a month that would be what we designated chronic. And it's its own illness at that point. I think, did we get them all, Julian? Okay, I think so.
I was scrolling down, yeah.
Did I miss one? Oh, someone asked, can you say more about how migraine can cause clenching or clenching causes migraine? So it's really, this is a really good question. So can I bring the trigeminal picture back up? Because I think I want to show you that the clenching is a biomechanical feature that can create hypersensitivity of the trigeminal nerve. It does not cause migraine. Okay. So it's very important to understand that clenching doesn't necessarily cause migraine. Clenching or bruxism, sleep apnea, these things that can actually encourage hypersensitivity of trigeminal nerve. And so once trigeminal nerve is hypersensitized, then you have these triggers, and then you have a genetic component, and a gender component, and a change component. Those things then will ignite the migraine. It's very important to understand that clenching doesn't cause migraine. Clenching encourages the potential for migraine. Does that make sense? Like it's causation and correlation are not the same. So for me, like I've had so much work done on my temporomandibular joint, and it's wonderful. It really is helpful, I think, for me having decreased frequency in migraine, which is so valuable. Like just to have like one less day per month of migraine, absolutely fantastic. But like it's not, it doesn't cause migraine. Migraine typically is a neurogenic inflammation that's different than I clench, therefore I have migraine. Clenching can certainly increase someone's predisposition. And we'll talk about this next week, and I hate to put it off till next week, but I want to give it its due service. We're going to talk about norepinephrine, serotonin, dopamine, neurotransmitters, and their relationships to migraine and their relationships to clenching. And I think that's going to be fascinating for you folks to understand that when someone has a receptor dysfunction and has a neurotransmitter dysfunction associated with said receptor dysfunction, that can precipitate clenching, which also precipitates migraine. So it's like migraine and clenching are actually can be caused by the same neurotransmitter dysfunction, not necessarily that clenching causes migraine. Does that make sense? I'm hoping that comes across clear, because I think it's very hard sometimes to discern like who caused this, who was the propagating feature. And I've been trying to figure that out for 20 years. And what really causes migraine are the genes, the gender, and the change. Okay. That's what caused migraine. The things that make us hypersensitive to feeling things, why we feel them, where we feel them, is biomechanical. Why we feel the intensity that we feel is hardly ever biomechanical. And that's how I describe it to my patients. I'm like, why you feel it, where you feel it is biomechanical. That's like TMJ, right? Why you feel the intensity that you feel it is hardly ever your temporomandibular joint dysfunction, but the chemical relationships. And that's why I don't know about you folks, but I mean, I went through chiropractic school and it was really hard and it was really amazing. But there was, I think with the bureaucracy of having the red tape of having to make everything so reproducible as far as board exams and what have you, there was this big missing piece for me in understanding pathomechanisms and how I might play a role in helping someone with that. And nothing against my school. I'm so proud to be a graduate of my school. It's just, I don't think that they had the time to do it. And it's our time now to understand it together. And so cannot wait to talk to you more about the jaw, the cranium, the neck, the biomechanical piece next week. But I wanted you to understand why I didn't talk about it this week, because it doesn't cause migraine. Okay. It doesn't. What causes migraine? What were they again? Gender, genes, and change. Those typically are the hugest factors to the neurogenic inflammatory cascade. People are trying to recategorize migraine as an inflammatory disorder, a neurogenic inflammatory disorder, a brain disorder. Do you guys know what the brain prize is? The brain prize is they give it away in Europe to the person with the biggest effect on research on neuroscience. And this year it went to researchers on migraine. Is that so cool? They won $1 million for their connection of calcitonin gene-related peptide, this neuropeptide that we were talking about, this excitatory neuropeptide. It's a necessary chemical, but it hypersensitizes trigeminal nerve. And it's that chemical that that promotes migraine. And so they have been able to create these medications that we'll talk about in the next, you know, Wednesdays that can help with that part. So it was really important for us on this first week to talk about trigeminal nerve, the greater occipital nerve, the cortical depression, spreading depression, the fact that this is a chemical cascade, and that why we feel the intensity that we feel migraine is because of that. It's not because of clenching. But I am so happy that you brought that up, because next week, and it sounds like I'm just putting you off till next week, like your favorite TV show, right? But next week we'll put more pieces together on the biomechanics of that and how those relate. Was there another one? Did I miss one? Okay. Can I ask you guys a question to win a poster? So can you give me the first person in the chat? So get ready, okay? The first person in the chat that can give me the three branches of trigeminal nerve. Because trigeminal means three roots, right? So the three branches. And I'm going to send you a poster. It's a really nice poster. You can't say V1, V2, V3. That's too easy. Ophthalmic maxillary mandibular. Very good. So the first person that did it was Tommy. So Tommy, can you email me? I'm going to write my email right here and just tell me I won your Nerf poster. So, and I'm sorry, I didn't have it. I forgot to pull it up, Julian. My apologies, but I'll pull it up next time. Each hour, I'm going to give you guys a Nerf poster for the person that answers one of the questions correctly. It's a beautiful poster. We worked really hard on it with the macular dissection. We teach a Nerf course, so we wanted to produce a Nerf poster for people. And I want you guys to have one. You guys deserve it. And it's got trigeminal nerve on it. V1, V2, V3, right? The ophthalmic, maxillary, and the mandibular divisions. Great job, Tommy. Great job to everyone who answered. Thank you so much for coming today and being interested in migraine. I'm so happy that you folks want to help other people. Maybe it's, you know, you've been personally afflicted. It's none of my business, but I share all my business. Obviously it's TMI. Every time I talk to Julian, it's like, here's Julie again talking about her experience. But I'm so passionate about migraine because my migraine incidence has gone way down, folks. It's gone way down from when I was in my 20s. To me, it was so unmanageable. And now I can really, for the most part, manage them. It's, you know, when I say for the most part, because when you have one, it's just, it's awful. But I really understand a lot more and I'm able to help people. I'm like this migraine magnet. People with migraine find me. And I'm like, and the first thing I say to them is I'm a migraineur. I'm a migraine sufferer. And they're like, you too? And it's like, you immediately bond with your patient. I'm like, yes. And I'm willing to share anything that you want to hear personally, but your experience is going to be different than mine. Everyone with migraine has the N=1. It's so different, but there are things that are the same, right? Like the symptoms are pretty similar, right? We got the unilateral pain, the throbbing sensation, the nausea, vomiting, the tendency to be worse upon movement. Those are really consistent for people with migraine. And so we'll talk more about like the differential diagnosis of migraine versus not migraine, because I've caught a lot of people that were misdiagnosed with migraine and didn't have it. So we'll discuss that more. And also next week, we'll talk more about the biomechanics. I know that you can't know me without leaving with a little bit of anatomy. It's just too helpful to ignore. I'm actually not dissecting the trigeminal nerve today, but I'm very excited when I get to, because it's the largest cranial nerve. It's the nerve, the biggest nerve of migraine. It's, you know, 90% of the afferents that you experience most likely is from trigeminal. It's what's postulated, but also greater occipital nerve and then direct thalamic, you know, parietal lobe activation of pain receptors. But other than that, like, it's mostly trigeminal. So understanding that biomechanically can be a huge piece to your patients. So we'll talk more about that. So thank you so much for all of your interest and letting me talk about the anatomy of migraine part one. And so next week we'll get into more of the biomechanics. We'll also talk about we'll get started on some of the treatments. And then our third hour, we're going to talk about all the things that you can do to help someone. And if you are that someone, there's some things you may not have thought about yet. And there are things that I did not think about. I went through a lot of schooling and no one talked to me about it. So I was like, oh, okay. For this particular disorder to affect so many millions of people on Earth, and for us to be like, about it, it's just unacceptable. So I'm so happy that you 20 plus are here, and anyone in the future that watches this, thank you so much for helping people with migraine. As well, as much as it is a loss to revenue, to a loss of productivity, to pain, to loss of connections with family, to so much, there's hope for people with migraine, and it comes with our understanding of how to help them.
Thank you, Kathy. Wonderful. And thank you, everyone, for joining us. And have a good week, everybody. And check our schedule for other webinars and courses. And the recordings for this will be up within 24 hours to replay. If you're watching the replay, we look forward also to meeting you next week, hopefully. And the audio is downloadable for you to listen to offline or in your practice to recap. So have a great week. Thank you, Kathy. And
thank
see you,
you.
Same time next week.
See you next week, folks. Thank you so much, Julian. Thanks to everybody at Embodied Health Learning. Bye.
Thank you all. Bye-bye.